Anna shivered as the horse-drawn carriage rumbled along the stony path. There was a chill in the air on this moonlit night, and rain clouds loomed ominously in the distance. "Nearly there, my dear," her father said in the seat next to her, as if sensing her apprehension. They had both been invited to a business dinner at the family home of a wealthy nobleman. Nothing unusual about that. Her father, a real estate tycoon, attended dozens upon dozens of such business meetings. But their host, something about all this made Anna uneasy, and a shiver crept up her spine. Still, she retained her smile quite effectively. Her mother had taught her this well, the art of remaining calm, graceful, despite fear and misgivings. Anna recalled the strange words in the letter inviting the two of them to dinner from the mysterious count by the name of Dracula. "I wish for both of you to join me at my home for dinner in 2 weeks' time. Please enter freely of your own will." The count was rumored to be somewhat eccentric. Perhaps he simply had an odd way with words. Thunder suddenly crashed above them, and the night sky was briefly illuminated with a fork of brilliant lightning, and rain began to fall. Anna shuddered once more. This carriage ride seemed as though it would never end. Then, all of a sudden, a castle appeared in front of them, emerging from the fog and driving rain. So this was the home of the Count. What sort of businessman lives in a castle? "Ah, here we are," Anna's father exclaimed. "We shall see this entire matter settled before long." The rain began to come down harder as they approached the sinister structure, and another booming crack of thunder bellowed from above. Anna wondered if this storm was a harbinger of things to come. Her previously calm facade slowly gave way to fright. And indeed, she was right to be worried. The Blood Drinkers, a bite-sized fright. This series contains disturbing content. Listener discretion is advised. The carriage rushed into the porte cochere of the castle, and the horses came to a halt. "Beastly weather," said Anna's father. "Simply beastly." Then suddenly, they could see a dark figure looming in a nearby doorway, silhouetted by the light from within the building. "My guests," the figure called out to them. "Come in. Let us get you out of this rain. Please enter freely of your own will." That strange choice of words again. This must be their host, the Count. Anna thought it peculiar that the Count wouldn't have servants to answer the door. Did they not always have servants in castles? Although, perhaps he simply preferred to greet his guests in person. Anna and her father hurried out of the carriage and through the door where their host stood waiting. "Welcome, my friends," the man said as Anna and her father shook off the rain and cold. "I am very pleased to have you here tonight for dinner." The figure before them was tall and somewhat gaunt, pale-skinned but not unattractive. His black, wavy hair was slicked back, and his dark eyes seemed to bore into Anna, though he did not seem unfriendly. A servant emerged, a young girl no more than 20 years of age or so, to take their coats. "Thank you, my dear," Dracula addressed the girl, then turned back to his guests. "Why don't you follow me into the dining area and have a drink?" "Splendid idea," Anna's father almost shouted. He seemed strangely overeager and nervous about this meeting. Anna wasn't privy to the details, but her father had been acting anxiously about this real estate deal, or whatever it was, since receiving the letter from the Count 2 weeks ago. These negotiations certainly seemed important, and she did not wish to spoil any of it, seem unreceptive, insufficiently charming, perhaps. The only reason she was even there was to appease her father and enable the negotiations with this Count to go as smoothly as possible. She would be nothing but polite, and give careful thought to every word she uttered. Anna swallowed, tried her best to regain her composure, squashing down the fear that lurked inside her. Count Dracula's castle seemed curiously old and new at the same time, Gothic architecture with some modern trappings. His dining area, as he called it, looked quite different from any Anna had seen before. It was lavishly decorated with artifacts and oddities from around the world. The Count must be somewhat of a historian, or a traveller, or simply a collector of historical items, Anna thought. One item in particular caught her attention, an old shield emblazoned with a sigil in the shape of a dragon. The Count noticed Anna's gaze. "My family crest, the dragon," he said. "Ah, yes," her father interjected. "Dracul, it means dragon, does it not?" "Indeed," the Count replied. "You know your history. It is an ancient word, our family name. But please, do sit down." The Count held a chair out for Anna as she took her seat at the opulent table in the center of the hall. Another servant appeared, a woman slightly older than the girl who had previously taken their coats. She did not speak, and she did not look at Anna nor at her father. A cask of wine somehow emerged. She must have been carrying it all along, Anna thought to herself. Strangely, she had not noticed it until just now. The servant poured some of the wine into two goblets sitting before them. "Aren't you having some wine too, Count?" her father asked. "I'm afraid not," replied the Count. "I do not drink wine. But please, indulge all you wish. Dinner will be ready shortly." The night wore on, and soon the last vestiges of light had vanished from the sky, and nothing could be seen through the windows except blackness, dark as ink, and an ominous moon hanging in the distance as though watching them, a great blank eye. Anna and her father enjoyed a succulent feast and generous helpings of wine, and indeed perhaps Anna's father had enjoyed the proceedings a little too much. In the course of discussing business with the Count, he became increasingly intoxicated, slurring his speech, and eventually, after dinner, passed out right there at the table. "It appears as though your father enjoyed my hospitality, my dear," the Count smirked. "Thoroughly so, it seems. But what about you? I feel as if our dreary business dominated the conversation this evening. I must apologize. Did you enjoy the meal?" The Count gazed at Anna, and her head started to feel heavy. She had not drunk to excess, yet she felt her mind swimming. "I am grateful that you came here to visit me tonight, Anna," the Count said. Taken aback, Anna raised her goblet in the direction of the Count, offering him a sip of her wine in an attempt to stave off his apparent advances. "My dear, as I explained, I don't drink wine," the Count replied, then paused. "Only blood." Anna didn't understand the Count's words at first, and then he crept towards her, eyes fixated on hers, and she felt unable to move or speak. Blood! What was this strange man saying? The hall seemed to shrink as the Count approached, and his flowing black cloak appeared to envelop the room around them. Why wouldn't her father wake up? She screamed inside, but no sound formed on her lips. She was somehow helpless, transfixed, her eyes seemingly locked on the Count's unblinking gaze. He suddenly lunged at her, seized her by the throat, and tore at her blouse to expose his skin. Anna's pale flesh shone, illuminated by the moonlight pouring in through the arched window behind the Count. And then she saw them, fangs gleaming as brightly as the white moon outside the window, as the Count opened his mouth widely and plunged his teeth into her neck, clutching at her breast. Anna screamed, suddenly able to cry out. The pain was gone as quickly as it had begun. And then a strange wave of ecstasy washed over her. As the Count stepped backwards, bracing himself against the table and wiping the blood from his mouth, she felt her vision begin to fade. Was she dying? Her father remained slumped backwards in his seat, completely oblivious to what had just happened. She looked on as she felt herself beginning to slip out of consciousness. The Count steadied himself and moved towards her father, fangs shining, wet with Anna's blood, as she finally succumbed to the darkness. In 1897, Irish author Bram Stoker wrote the novel Dracula, introducing the legendary horror figure to the world, one that would be the subject of hundreds upon hundreds of subsequent books and films. Although it is perhaps the most well-known vampire novel these days, it was not the first to portray a sophisticated aristocrat who feeds on blood. English writer John Polidori's novel, The Vampire, was published in 1819 and is arguably the most influential vampire work of its time. The notion of such undead creatures has existed for thousands of years, although the term vampire was popularized in 18th century Europe during a mass hysteria. The panic became so widespread that public executions of people believed to be such vampires began to take place. These creatures have been portrayed in many different forms over the years. Some people believe them to be witches or reanimated corpses of malevolent beings. Others believe them to be evil spirits who possessed corpses or bit their victims in order to turn them into bloodthirsty creatures, much like the common portrayal of vampires in modern times. In European folklore, vampires were often described as bloated with dark faces, a stark difference from the thin, pale bloodsuckers we know today. In film, vampires have been portrayed many different ways over the years, from romanticized versions such as Interview with the Vampire, based on the gothic novel by Anne Rice, to comedy horror movies such as Fright Night and The Lost Boys, to Werner Herzog's frighteningly realistic and stylized reinterpretation of F.W. Murnau's 1922 silent film, Nosferatu. Add to that the classic retellings of Universal and Hammer films, including both Bela Lugosi and Christopher Lee's legendary turns as the infamous Count Dracula, and you've got a veritable cornucopia of blood-sucking horror. In Bram Stoker's novel, Dracula is a Transylvanian noble who feeds on blood for nourishment. However, as is often the case, sometimes truth is much more gruesome than fiction. "My lord," the guard shouted as he shoved a spear into the back of the prisoner, prodding him mercilessly towards the dais ahead of them. A grim figure sat upon the throne, dressed in a lavish cloak decorated with jewels, observing the man with sadistic glee. "Bring the traitor before me," he growled. The guard thrust the man in the direction of the throne with a sharp blow that knocked the wind from his lungs. "On your knees, swine," bellowed the glowering man, the ruler of Wallachia and a brutal tyrant. The guard viciously clubbed the prisoner's head with the butt of his spear and forced the man down to the ground. "Now then," snarled the looming figure before the prisoner, "you are accused of treason and the murder in cold blood of a member of my court, one of my closest confidants."
My lord," the prisoner stammered.
"Silence, traitor," the ruthless ruler bellowed. "You are guilty of treason and murder in cold blood. For this, you are condemned to death by the stake. But first," the tyrant flashed a wicked grin and motioned to several guards standing nearby. The guards knew what was coming next. They had seen it hundreds of times before. It always ended in the same gruesome, bloody display. The guard swiftly approached the prisoner, unsheathing his dagger. He raised it high above the doomed man, then plunged the weapon deeply into his shoulder. The prisoner screamed in pain, writhing as the dagger was yanked backwards, blood spraying from the gaping wound and oozing down over his arm.
"Hounds!"
The sinister man rose from the throne and gestured towards the prisoner, now lying in a pool of blood that grew ever larger by the second. Suddenly, two huge, feral dogs sprang from their resting places in a cage on the far side of the throne room. They charged towards the prisoner with reckless abandon, spittle flying from their foaming mouths, eyes wide with chaos and fury. The prisoner pathetically tried to shield himself, crying out and swatting at the beasts in a feeble attempt to somehow repel his bloodthirsty attackers. It was to no avail. Their gnashing, razor-sharp teeth were soon embedded in his flesh, ripping and tearing skin from bone, gnawing away at bloody chunks of meat as the prisoner wailed in agony. The tyrant approached the gory scene and cackled with malicious delight. "Excellent," he shouted. "A well-deserved feast for my two faithful companions. Enough!" He motioned again towards several guards, who pulled the wild beasts off the prisoner, who lay now in a bloody mess on the floor in the center of the throne room. Somehow, he was still alive. "He shall die by the stake," the ruler shouted. "Guards, away with this treacherous pig. See to it that he dies slowly. I want this backstabbing rat to feel every last drop of blood leaving his body." A pair of guards carried the prisoner away, dragging his limp body into the courtyard of the castle. The poor wretch struggled in vain against his captors, but his fate was sealed. The guards shoved him upwards onto scaffolding nearby a sharpened wooden stake, pressing him backwards towards the ominous object. The man flailed desperately, knowing his death was fast approaching. It was no use. The guards grasped him under each arm and raised him off his feet. The condemned man gazed into the sky, crying out to the Lord, and for a moment it seemed as if time stood still, that perhaps his salvation was at hand. But alas, it was not to be. The tyrant's men plunged him down onto the stake, the sharp wood bursting through his chest, shattering bone and tearing through flesh as it ripped up through him. He heaved, choking for air, then coughed a fountain of blood, splurting gore across the guards' faces.
"I curse you and your vile master,"
the prisoner managed to gasp.
"You will pay for your atrocities in this life or the next."
And then the man fell silent. Bram Stoker drew upon many sources when he penned his famous work, Dracula. One of them was Countess Bathory, a woman suspected of committing many barbaric deeds and heinous murders. We have discussed her in an earlier episode of Bite-Sized Frights, The Blood Countess. However, more than anything, the fictional Dracula in Stoker's novel was based on a nobleman, a Romanian national hero, Vlad Tepes, also known as Vlad the Impaler for his tendency to, befitting his name, impale his enemies, as it was his favorite method of execution. Many claim that the similarities between the vicious warlord Vlad and the sophisticated but wicked Count Dracula of fiction are exaggerated, especially the Transylvanian connection, which has been disputed, as some researchers now claim that Vlad indeed spent very little, if any time, in Transylvania during his lifetime. Nonetheless, there are some chilling similarities between the two men. Vlad Tepes was the second legitimate son of Vlad II Dracul, a member of the Order of the Dragon, a military fraternity founded by the Holy Roman Emperor Sigismund in 1408. Vlad II's moniker, Dracul, from which the name Dracula would eventually be derived, was awarded by the Order. His son, Vlad III, who would later become known as the Impaler, was well known for his cruelty and barbarity. In one account, Turkish messengers came to pay their respects to Vlad III, but refused to take off their turbans according to ancient customs. Vlad decided to strengthen their custom by nailing the turbans to the men's heads, so that they could not remove them even if they wished to. In another account, Vlad had a large copper cauldron constructed with a small hole at the top. He placed his victims inside the cauldron, with their heads sticking out through the holes, then filled the cauldron with water and lit a fire underneath, boiling his prisoners to death. In the summer of 1462, during a campaign against the Ottomans, Vlad executed the people of an entire city, numbering 20,000 in total, impaling men, women and children alike on giant wooden stakes in what was described as the Forest of the Impaled. No one was spared. Children were thrust onto stakes with their mothers attached to one another in a depraved fashion. Birds made their nests in the intestines of the corpses. For his more hated enemies, Vlad preferred to use a blunted wooden stake smeared in animal fat. His enemy would be impaled through the anus by the wooden spike, then raised high, allowed to slowly slide down the stake as it pushed through their body, obliterating their organs before finally emerging through their shoulder. Sometimes it would take those impaled days to die. Although a brutal tyrant, Vlad was regarded as a just ruler who punished criminals and executed enemies of the state, strengthening the government. He held 3 different reigns in a historical region of Romania, then known as Wallachia, warring against the Ottoman Empire and being imprisoned multiple times. He was killed in battle sometime in the winter of 1476 or early 1477. His tomb and place of burial remains a mystery to this day. It should be noted that some of the horrific stories surrounding Vlad Tepes may have been exaggerated, or possibly even fabricated by his enemies. Nonetheless, he did leave a bloody legacy during his reign. It was not until Bram Stoker's novel in the late 19th century, however, that a connection between Dracula and vampiric entities took form. What do you think? Do these bloodthirsty creatures known as vampires truly exist? Was Vlad the Impaler merely a ruthless, barbaric tyrant, or was he conflated with the legend of the undead, blood-sucking count for a more sinister reason? Perhaps Bram Stoker was onto something when he chose the name Dracula for his most famous literary work. We would love to hear your own thoughts and theories about these bloodthirsty fiends. If you have enjoyed this episode, please follow us on Twitter and Instagram at PixelElixir, and at Instagram at Bite-Sized Frights. You can also subscribe at BiteSizedFrights.com so that you never miss any of our terrifying tales. This has been a Pixel Elixir production, narrated by Chris Kay. Thank you for listening. Until the next bite, my friends.